This is The Enragé, a show where we take a deeper dive into written works published at the Center for a Stateless Society. Join us as we give voice to the ideas challenging the vain phantoms that haunt our social reality and stand in the way of total liberation. For more information, visit c4ss.org. And to support this show or any of the other projects happening at the center, please visit patreon.com/c4ss.org. Thank you for listening. Hello, and thank you for tuning in to The Enragé. I'm your host, Joel Williamson. Today we'll be joined by the Tech Learning Collective to discuss an article they wrote titled Imagining an Optimistic Cyber Future. Tech Learning Collective is an apprenticeship-based technology school for radical organizers founded in New York City that provides a security-first IT infrastructure curriculum to otherwise underserved communities and organizations advancing social justice causes. TLC trains politically self-motivated individuals in the arts of hypermedia, information technology, and radical political practice. The piece we'll be discussing today is an imaginative exploration of radical strategies for a liberatory techno future. Tech Learning Collective, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting us on the show, Joel, and thanks for having us here.
Of course. Before we start breaking down your article, I wanted to ask you a few questions about the Tech Learning Collective, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in TLC, and what are your ultimate goals with the project?
That's a good question. It's also sort of a different, you'll get a different answer depending on who you ask, right? So I'll give you an answer from me, and then I think I would also point people to the Tech Learning Collective website, right? So techlearningcollective.com/about. But personally, I got involved relatively early on in about 2015, 2016-ish or so. At the time, there was a mutual self-education group, sort of a semi-private technical training group in New York City. Mostly folks who were trying to just sort of like make some material headway in the situations that they found themselves in their lives. We got a sort of a somewhat of a boost in the November 2016 elections for reasons I think you can imagine. So for me personally, it was sort of like seeing a self-motivated group of people who were like, these are the things that we find a priority as infrastructure for the other things that we want to accomplish, right? And some of us had more experience than others in a technical sort of like computer IT background. But the goal was really basically just self-education. It was basically a private study group, if you will, that sort of happened in a bunch of these anarchist-occupied spaces in New York City around that time. So that's kind of when I got started and how I got involved. I've been a digital security sort of like, I don't want to say aficionado because that sort of like, you know, makes it sound a little bit hobbyistic, but it's been an important part of my activism personally. So that's sort of where I started offering my own personal contributions. And so everyone sort of has their own sort of like intake story like that. But the goal sort of was very much like, you know, we all recognize that these skills are skills that are a site of more possibility in certain respects, which is to say, you know, if you were trying to do a kind of organizing in, let's say, 1970s New York City, right? Like the Lower East Side has a very rich history of radical activism. Mm-hmm. There were tactics that were more available to you than in other places in America, right? Because of the way New York City was sort of like structured. I mean, it's an urban center. It has different needs and it has different opportunities than other places. So that's also true in the digital realm. And today, you know, if you were to try to, for example, you know, distribute food from a grocery store, you know, you would very quickly be approached by very militarized police resistance. That's not a tactic that's then as accessible and feasible, right, as a direct action tactic for a lot of scenarios today. But those same constraints are lifted in cyberspace, at least for now, at least in some ways. And so it became very obvious to a lot of people that a prerequisite of getting meaningful material revolutionary possibility has begun to transition towards spaces that are not as heavily policed because, bluntly, the police are not as good as policing there. And that is in the internet right now, at least for the time being. So that was our sort of like initial motivation, like how can we use this sort of new space as almost, you know, not to overuse an analogy, but this almost Wild West space to actually push forward material impacts in community scale affinity groups and efforts. And we have to get really good at that as quickly as possible. So that was the start. That was sort of the founding vision. And that's then, of course, evolved into a number of different community groups that have sort of spun out of Tech Learning Collective projects from 2015, 2016, 2017, and so on, that we now call alumni groups. We now have this sort of more formalized school, which is the Tech Learning Collective at this point, right? And although, you know, people come now with multitude of different motivations, we focus very, very intentionally on those with political ambitions.
Cool. So how often do you all write cool articles like the one we're going to be discussing today?
Well, so we try to write as much as we can. There's a lot of work that goes into the day-to-day of what we're doing, so we don't always spend all of our effort on writing. We have recently tried to get more articles out more quickly just because we're in a position where we can, you know, we have an infrastructure now of our own that we can sort of build on top of and grow. And sort of our writing efforts with C4SS has been, first of all, very well received, which is nice to see, and mostly an effort to try to just like make more people aware that there is an opportunity for those with political ambitions, right, to learn about sort of the infrastructural digital technologies that are mediating so much of our lives now, in a way that doesn't also overlap with, for example, recruitment industry, you know, Silicon Valley bullshit. Sorry, I don't know if I can use that word on this show.
Yes, absolutely. You get a golden coin every time you curse.
Oh, nice. Well, then I might curse a lot more. but yeah, so that's where the writing came from. We're trying to have a cadence of about once a month. You'll probably not see that many articles only because we're not that huge a group and we don't always have quite as much to say. So if you do want to see additional writing, definitely the C4SS site is where we're hoping to publish more things in the upcoming future. We actually have a piece in the works right now for next month. But other than that, of course, there's also the techlearningcollective.com blog itself.
Is TLC an explicitly anarchist organization, or is it just made up of people who identify or have some affinity toward anarchism?
Yeah, that's also a really good question, right? And so this is a conversation that we had internally, and we sometimes continue to have internally. The short answer is it's kind of de facto an anarchist and autonomous organization, just because, you know, everyone who's involved has some far left leaning along those lines. But for reasons of mostly just public palatability and also simply, it doesn't really matter, right? If you are self-identifying as an anarchist or an autonomist or whatever, if you are excited by the same possibility, by doing the same things that we're excited about, you know, creating alternative networks to, you know, the surveilled internet, finding ways to increase your digital privacy or capabilities for the purpose of community and communal, you know, action, then it doesn't matter to us how you identify your politics. And so we've taken extremely intentionally sort of not politically neutral, but political identity neutral tack without also trying to hide the fact that we have some obvious anarchist ideals. And that has served us well so far. So we're probably going to keep doing that for a little while longer.
Right. And there's all sorts of different types of anarchist organizing and anarchisms, right?
Yeah.
What drew you towards C4SS?
I mean, I hope this is okay to say on a C4SS podcast, but like nothing in particular, right? Like, so the reason why...
Tech positive stuff, maybe.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, like, you know, we don't really care, right, from a project perspective about the strains of anarchy per se. Like, it's an interesting academic, you know, conversation, but it's important, and that's an important conversation, surely, because academics are actually rather important, right? We should be aware of the theory of the stuff that we are doing, 100%. And at the same time, at the end of the day, like, you know, an academic textbook is not where the rubber meets the road in most people's lives. So it doesn't particularly matter. So when we started the further outreach efforts to like say, you know, hey, we're a school, but we're not like, because people were very quick to assume that we were very much like a code boot camp, like a Flatiron school or a General Assembly or a Turing school, you know, one of these sort of like what we call a school to corporation pipeline, right? Who have a rush to employment style of teaching and you have to sort of learn to the test and then get like a license and so on. And we aren't anything like that. But a lot of people were assuming that we were. So we said, we got to up the politics a little bit. You know what I mean? Like get people to understand that like we don't really care about cooperation with the job market per se. We care about it in the sense of like, you know, individuals today still need to have some income in a fiat currency that is regulated by a state to survive, which is an abomination, obviously, but it is the reality that most of us live in. So we care about it in that sense, but we're not as a project trying to get people jobs. Like that's not the goal, right? And it very much is the goal for other sorts of like boot camps and tech education initiatives and so on. And so that's why we're like, well, we gotta do something to like differentiate this a little bit more clearly. And so we basically just started writing these pieces that were, you know, political in intent, not with an identity label associated, but just with like, what is the action out of it? Like, what is the outcome of the thing that we're trying to do? And we sent some of these pieces to a number of publications, C4SS being one of them. And, you know, two things appealed to us about C4SS. Number one is, as you mentioned, there was a tech sort of positive or an appreciation of the capabilities, right, that technology offered. And that was also not just spoken about, but it was also evident to us in how you responded, right? Like, and how C4SS, or maybe not you, but like, you know, how people at C4SS, right, were able to communicate back with us. So it was simply quicker, right? I mean, like, you know, C4SS answers faster with more detail and with more clear thought. And I mean, not a little bit faster, but like by weeks, right? Faster than most other publications that we've ever communicated with. And that speaks to the existence of internal processes that make use of the kind of capabilities we're talking about, right? So it's a little bit of a relationship of convenience, not to which I don't mean to be insulting. I hope it's not, but it's also a well-aligned organization in that respect.
Cool. Well, let's go ahead and move into your actual article now, I guess.
Sure.
What is society if not the aggregate of communication between individuals? That's a quote in your article that somewhat captures the trajectory of where you're going in the piece. Why did you choose cybernetics, among other things, as a major focus?
Yeah, so we really like this question. And we talked just a little bit before the show about that being a question that we sort of get also somewhat often, which is to say that a lot of people ask us about cybernetics generally or interest in cybernetics. And it kind of makes sense, right? Like there's the word cyber, right, is in there. And so it aligns with a lot of what people think of what we do. And this is probably a good opportunity to sort of like mention that, yes, you know, cybernetics, right, is basically, right, the formal study of inanimate feedback loops. That's not the academic definition, but that's how I would like think of it, right? Basically, it means like, so given the ability to sense something about the world via like a thermometer or like a motion detector or whatever, right? And then you have another ability to change something about the world, right, via like a microcontroller or a mechanical actuator or, again, some other tool, whatever, right? Or your hand, right, anything. Then cybernetics describes how to build systems that have some desired outcome from those two fundamental components. That's often what's called like a closed loop system, and that's probably what people have heard about, like when they talk about feedback loops or closed loop systems. To, for example, like an air conditioner, right, is a cybernetics system because it has a thermometer, and then it sort of self-regulates the temperature in an area, right, and then as the change in the air temperature gets sensed by the sensor, then the air conditioner turns back on again, right? So that's a cool idea, right? But we're not totally, like, it's not that we're interested in cybernetics per se. It's not actually our focus. And, or maybe it may be a better way to say that, right, is that cybernetics is as much our focus as meditation or poetry or linguistics or history, right, or philosophy. Cybernetics is best thought of as like just one way of thinking about certain elements of human experience, but no better than, for example, music is, right, or anarchism, right? So any hyper-focus on a single topic, right, will always sort of be somewhat myopic and bluntly a little bit boring. And worse than that, right, it makes these implementations that breed design flaws in ideals that are then easy to overlook because you've hyper-focused, right, on like one particular way of thinking about something. And those tend to inevitably fail. So I've heard this described, right, by anarchists as blueprintism. A favorite book of mine is James C. Scott's book, Seeing Like a State, which is a wonderful exposition of exactly this kind of myopic hyperfocus, right, and how it fails in the context of government. So this is like super relevant to learning about technology because in our opinion, right, the best software engineers are not actually computer science majors, right? We found that they are generally subpar systems thinkers more often than not. But philosophers are actually really great. Like philosophers excel at the practice of reasoning about computer systems precisely because, right, they study reasoning itself. And this is perhaps no more famously expressed than in the Tor project, which is this sort of like privacy enhancing and identity concealing overlay network used by journalists and whistleblowers. It was made famous by Edward Snowden. We teach Tor at great length in our curriculum. We had actually a number of workshops about it specifically. And like when, so talking about these sort of like hyper, you know, sort of computer security things, a lot of people would assume that the creators of those things, right, would be these sort of like computer graybeards, right? Paul Syverson, though, the inventor of the onion routing scheme on which Tor is based, actually holds 3 academic degrees in philosophy and only 1 in mathematics and none in computer science at all. His story getting to the TOR project and creating that at the NRL, the Naval Research Laboratory, back in the 90s, is one that begins with picking up a Jobs for Philosophers magazine, literally a magazine called Jobs for Philosophers. That's all that was in that magazine, just job postings for philosophy majors.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, it
that must have been very popular among philosophers, but not popular among anyone else.
Pretty much, right? And I tell this story like to sort of showcase just how important it is to think about computer systems without the hyper-focus on what we think today of what computer systems are or could be, right? So in the same vein, right, like cybernetics is interesting, but it's not more interesting than anything else. And because it's just sort of like more familiar in terms of what people think that we do, we get asked about it a lot. But our focus, both in class times for the project generally and for our, you know, personally for ourselves, right, is the interweaving of all these different concepts. We talk as much about philosophy and history and sort of like, you know, Gnosticism, for example, even comes up in our networking classes, right? As we do about computer technology or cybernetics or, you know, some sort of like what we would consider today a hard tech concept, because those are just sort of detailed expressions of something that's a far more foundational concept. And those are the things that politically self-motivated people, I think, both are, you know, more interested in, but also, because they're more interested in them, right, have a much better opportunity to use that interest as a foundation or springboard to learn about the details that are expressed in some specific area of expertise, like computers, or permaculture, or anything else, right?
Awesome. Why is imagining an optimistic cyber future the first step towards improving our relationship with digital technology?
I don't mean to be glib with a short answer, but the sort of start and end of it, right, is that if we can't imagine something better than what currently exists today, then the best we can hope for is just stumbling through sheer luck into a better future, right? Like, we will have no direction and no sort of like ability to define for ourselves what better means. And so given the forces that are arrayed against, you know, those who would bend the arc of the moral universe towards justice, right, like sheer dumb luck, just it's just not good enough. If we want to be intentional about this, we have to first be imaginative about this. And you cannot have the intentionality without the imagination. So starting with a vision, an actual like imaginary of what it is that you want to move towards, really does have to be like step zero. You know, it has to be the first step. And that is also a step that takes time and effort and should take some focus. You know, TLC obviously has an idea of what we'd like to see a future look like. It's not the only vision. It's not necessarily the best one, but it is a guiding North Star, if you will, right, to get us towards that future. And we couldn't do anything that we did without imagining what we want. So that's why we started that way.
So how does cyberspace's infancy explain its volatility?
The article that we're talking about, the Imagining an Optimistic Cyber Future, is really kind of 3 articles in one, right? Like, it's kind of 3 essays that were weaved together into a quilt that is this article, if you will. And we open it, before we even start with one of the 3 sort of main topics of the essay, with trying to set a baseline of understanding around how young, which is to say how recent, right, how new cyberspace and the modern technical era, if you will, right, really is. And the reason for that is because a lot of people, especially younger people, for, you know, through no fault of their own, really don't seem to recognize just how new the internet and telecommunication generally really is. And so we open our piece, right, by reminding readers that, for example, the web was invented, not commercialized, right, not popularized, but invented a mere 33 years ago. So it's like younger than many of us, right? Like, and that's important to keep in mind, because a lot of people, especially like, you know, so-called tech people or people in the industry, right, or like professionals, right, they act like they know what they're doing, but they don't. I mean, how could they, right? Like, we have a capability that has never existed in all of human history before 33 years ago. So how could anyone reasonably claim to know what the fuck they're going to do with that? Like, they don't. They can't possibly know that. That is an obscenely, absurdly, the hubris of that is, it should be shocking, right? Because it's so new. And so, for what it's worth, like, if things feel chaotic, right, online right now, well, yeah, that's exactly why. Nobody knows what the fuck is going on. So nobody knows what's going to happen, which means there are more opportunities also, right, to determine the trajectory of the future than one might think, precisely because, right, things are so new. And so one way to think about this is like a laser pointer. Like if you point it at a wall, right? If you point a laser pointer at a wall 100 feet away, you only need to move your wrist a tiny fraction of an inch, right? To cause that dot on the wall to move many, many, many orders of magnitude more than the small distance your hand traveled, right? And so the point is that the effect is wildly outsized relative to the cause of that. Mm. And so that's basically what's going on with the internet, right? And the sociocultural effects it's having on the world right now. And that perspective we think is super important to keep in mind because it explains A, right? Why we feel things are so volatile, but B, also it gives us sort of a window of historical perspective, right? To remember that, like, hold the phone, you know, like we just learned how to write online. You know what I mean? Like people are still figuring out how links work. Like give it some time. Nothing is settled. The dust is still very much in the air. And that should be both, you know, an opportunity for those who are willing to invest in taking the time to learn about how that all works, and comfort for people who feel like everything is going haywire right now.
You described three great migrations of computing power. Can you briefly explain what those migrations are for the audience, please?
Sure, yeah. So this is also sort of like the intro to our article. As part of this sort of like expectation setting, because again, this is not a history everyone knows, and so we don't expect you to come to the article knowing it, but the important thing to sort of recognize about the moment in cyberspace history, if you will, that we are right now, is that there have sort of been what we see as these three, as you mentioned, these great migrations, right? So the first one is simply this creation of mechanical computing in the first place. This was like, you know, the 1800s era, right? By this we mean like the ability to perform computations by a machine. So like a machine could actually be the one computing, right? Rather than a human being. Because before such a machine existed, I think the earliest common example of this is the Babbage engine. Humans were the ones that were adding numbers or whatever in their heads or on paper, right, to do calculations. And so the first great migration is really just this Genesis moment or our metaphorical Big Bang when modern computing or cyberspace was kind of like first born, right? That's the era of the room-sized computer, these mainframes, these old, like, you know, big literal rooms whose entire, like, job was to house, right, the computer. In fact, it was called a mainframe, not because of like the mainframe, one word, is actually a contraction of two words, main and frame. And the reason it was called a mainframe is simply because the main frame of the computer was in that room, which of course means that other parts of the computer were not in that room. And like almost this gigantic octopus, if you imagine a mainframe, the room where the computer is, as being the head of the octopus, you can imagine its peripherals, which were in this case dumb terminals like, you know, keyboards and printers and other sort of disk devices that we now understand as being part of a computer, they were not actually part of the so-called mainframe. They were in other frames, literally boxes, right, outside the mainframe. So the mainframe was its own sort of special thing. That was sort of like the first, you know, era of this. The computing happened in the mainframe, in other words. The second migration didn't happen until the 1980s. So skip forward like pretty much 40, 50 years, right, past like World War I, World War II, all of it, until you get to the so-called personal computer or PC revolution in the 1980s. So before the 1980s, computing power only existed in these large mainframes. And if you wanted to perform some computation, right, you had to physically travel to the building or campus where that computer was located, because that's, again, that's where the compute power actually existed, in the mainframe. But in the 1980s, these PCs, these so-called personal computers, brought the ability to compute into residences, right, into homes and gardens, by literally by miniaturizing that whole sort of mainframe and its peripherals, its hard disk drive, right, its keyboard, and so on, into a size that would fit on a single desk or, you know, in the back of a garage or something. And that was a big change, for sure. But the compute power itself was still mostly isolated, right, to those single machines one at a time, because there wasn't any good way of connecting those PCs together. So we went from this sort of like Big Bang Genesis moment of like, we have these gigantic mainframes in these campuses that are dedicated just to that, to a sort of like an explosion, right, of compute power that dispersed the ability to compute into multiple locations. And so that's the second major migration. But that explosion, right, didn't connect all those pieces. And so that's where we're living. That's what we're going toward today. Most people, you know, today, you and I, we're talking on two personal computers, but we're connecting the two, right? So we're living today in this so-called third great migration, where now most compute power has actually sort of gone back to these gigantic data centers, whether they be government or corporate controlled, right? Like Amazon AWS or Facebook or Google, right? So you and I still have the ability to perform compute operations on our own devices, right? Again, that's why they're called computers, our laptops. But notice that the vast majority of the computing that we actually care about happens elsewhere. It's no longer on our local computer, right? It's in Google Docs or Amazon AWS or, you know, Twitter or Facebook or whatever. And those are so-called, these so-called cloud services, right? They run these so-called servers that claim to serve our whims. And those servers, and this is the important thing to understand today, are not fundamentally different than your laptop, right? The computer that runs Google Docs or Twitter, right, that creates the web page that you look at its core, it's just a personal computer moved into a data center. It's just like your laptop. It's running the same essential technology as you have in front of you right now that we're using to speak to each other, like on our own laptops, right? But what's different about it is that they hold or possess, right, the things that we care about. So rather than having your documents on your laptop, right, you keep them so-called in the cloud. So we kind of really shouldn't call them servers anymore. We should maybe call them possessors. But that's the third great migration of, like, now we've got our own compute power locally, but we're using that compute power with an over an interconnected network to then speak to other computers that possess the things we care about. Whereas in the second phase of that, the PC revolution of the 1980s, right, we were able to move the things we care about physically into our homes because the compute power was there and there was no network.
Mm-hmm. So the third migration is described as sort of a return in some ways to centralization.
Yeah, very much. It's centralization, but it's also this sort of like a weird hybrid where, right, like the first migration of truly centralized computing was the mainframe, right? You couldn't do anything without being physically located near a mainframe. And part of that's because as an individual, like you couldn't have an electronic computer in your house. There just did, such a thing just didn't exist. So you didn't have any of your own local compute, right? You couldn't have a machine calculate anything locally. You had to physically get on a bike and go to the campus and go to the machine room, right, computer lab, and ask the attendant, right, for permission to use the computer. and then you would be able to do some calculation. Cool. And then when the PC revolution happened in the 1980s, right, you didn't have to do that anymore. You could just go to your garage or your, you know, I mean, mostly assuming that you had the money to do this, which mostly meant that you were, you know, relatively well-off white man. But the point is, it's the same, right? Like the point is that you had the ability to do the local compute in your house. And that was a big shift. And so that decentralized compute power in a meaningful way, because it meant now that everyone individually was doing their own compute, right? They were doing the calculations at home. They were running their own PCs. The first stage of getting to the network then, which is to say, when we had a medium to connect all those individual computers together, i.e. the internet, what happened, and what is happening, right, slowly, is over the course of, say, from the 90s to the mid-2000s, right, to the 2010s, was this move back, this sort of pull, this gravitational force that sort of pulled where the important compute happens back to these large companies, these data centers. And what's different about it this time, right, is that in this third migration, is that we don't lose local compute. You and I are actually still getting more and more local compute all the time. I mean, look at a smartphone, for example, right? One of these babies is like way more powerful than any PC in the 1980s ever could hope to be. And so what's interesting is, what are we using local compute for? Well, we could use it for anything we could use compute for. But what we're actually using it for in the model of, say, Google Drive, right, is connecting to another computer somewhere else that actually has what we care about, right, over a network. And so the important compute is now happening in the data centers. Not that it has to, but that currently it is. And so that's sort of that, like, that pendulum swing, if you can imagine, from centralized to decentralized to centralized again. We're sort of in that third shift backwards. And, you know, we don't know how long necessarily that will last, but you can definitely picture that as like another third great migration, because now so much is like SaaS-based, right, software as a service, or really service as a software substitute kind of computing.
So the swing back to centralization was sort of recaptured by industry and by the state. Whether or not you agree with left-wing market anarchist conclusions, one huge strength, in my opinion, of left-wing market anarchist insight is its analysis of how capitalism happens, how it maintains itself, how it perpetuates itself, historically and currently, through direct and indirect subsidization, for example, or land theft, you know, closure of the commons, you know, blah, blah, blah. That might be another similarity that you sort of at least hinted at in your article with the merger of the state and corporations. But either way, what makes you confident that the pendulum will swing once again? And how do we bring about the next catalyzing event in order to move towards a free cyber future?
Well, yeah, further along in the article, we talk about the sort of like convergence between state and corporation, right? And I think that this is, I don't think this is a particularly unique insight or anything, but it's definitely the case that it is difficult to imagine the existence of the state without the corporations that are making it materially and technically possible to have such a thing. And vice versa as well. It's a little bit difficult to imagine the kinds of corporation we have now. Not to say that all corporations or all sort of methods of organizing economic activity are relying on that, but the ones we have now in a capitalist model absolutely rely on the state for the kinds of very obviously unbalanced advantages that some companies have over others, right? Depending on their position and their history and their inheritances. So the shift to the cloud, right, is absolutely a shift that happened in part, right, because of the inability for the general public at large to recognize the dangers of the conflation between state and corporation, in our opinion. However, right, if you look at the way that that migration happened, what you see is a pattern with the other previous sort of emergences, right, of these so-called great migrations. And so we're confident that this is going to swing back, right, to another sort of different form of organizing our computing infrastructures, in part because that pattern holds. And so what I mean by that is that all these shifts, like the first one, the second migration, and the third one to the cloud, right, what all these shifts have in common is that they each occurred when two factors, right, converged at the same time. And first, we had a given capability like dispersed compute power, for example, the PC revolution in the 1980s, right, or the network access sort of became more ubiquitous and available, i.e. internet access, right, which sort of precipitated the cloud. Those two things became tangible, meaning that people were actually able to experience it themselves, like have it, right, and use it, make use of it themselves. And second, that in each case, the emergence of that capability was the solution to a prior problem. So for example, a lack of individual compute, right, spurring the PC revolution in the 80s, the lack of intercomputer connectivity for the cloud, right? And so if we stop to think about it for a moment, there are some pretty obvious disadvantages to the current cloud model, right? Some are very clearly political problems. Like, for example, you can point at the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal, right? Data collection, that kind of stuff. But many are also just purely technical problems. Like, take the politics, take the economics out of it, and you can even just on a purely technical level see that the current sort of client-server architecture where everything is sort of on someone else's computer and you have to connect to it, right, does actually result in a less than optimal scenario for a lot of applications, right? And the trite example of this, right, is like, how do you watch Netflix if your internet connectivity goes down for a second, right? So we can just do the math. So like in the mid-2000s, it was way more feasible in terms of physical space and dollar cost, right, to store your own personal movie collection, say on physical discs, right, like on DVDs or on VHS cassettes before that. And that's why Netflix, when they started as a business, right, they started out by physically mailing DVDs to subscribers, because that was the fastest way to get the amount of data they needed to send to you, right? And so today, of course, it's actually faster and cheaper to send that same amount of data, not on a DVD that's printed and then shipped by courier, right, but like over the network itself, right? It's easier to do that than it is to mail somebody something. And it's not just easier, it's also actually faster for the same amount of data that at least they're dealing with. So Netflix became a streaming service because of that. Makes sense. Totally economically rational thing to do. But now if we look at it 20 years later or so, right, it's become both possible and economical for a single person to store something like, say, 1,000 high-res movies and TV shows on like a single several terabyte hard disk drive that they have in their home, their physical, like a physical device in their house. And that's like a digital analog to the physical movie collections in most households a few decades ago. But of course, it's larger and cheaper and, you know, easier to manage for all the reasons that digital things are easier to manage in the physical world. And so in other words, it became, right, possible to have this sizable personal movie collection in your own home that rivals anything that you might truly care about Netflix offering. And on top of that, right, with free software tools like Jellyfin and other sort of media center interfaces, it's getting a lot easier and easier, even for folks who don't have a ton of technical background, to manage that library and add new shows to it and sort of download things on the fly and, you know, rip things from streaming services and so on and so forth, right? And so if the internet goes down and you want to watch a TV show to buy the time, well, you know, in that, you know, scenario where you have everything local, no problem, right? Because you're using local compute and local network access. You can watch it on your iPad, you can watch it on your laptop, right? Because you've got this local network in your house that we also didn't have in the 1980s, right, called Wi-Fi routers. So this all was made possible, right, by the plummeting storage costs and improved software interfaces and, you know, more ubiquitous networking technologies, all of which is becoming easier and easier to use and more accessible to more people. And so instead of using the cloud, which is really just someone else's computer, you once again are able to see people actually beginning to personalize the experience, by which I mean not personalize in the way that like your marketing companies talk about it, but personalize by which I mean using your own personal resources, because all the devices you need to accomplish the tasks that we're talking about are in your own home. They are your personal resources. They are your personal things in your house, for example. So the thing to highlight about this sort of like pattern, right, is not that there's like some sort of clairvoyance premonition about what the future is going to hold here. It's that the writing was always on the wall already. This is just the 2020s version of what happened in the 1980s personal computer revolution. Some people, in fact, call this the personal cloud revolution, right? Again, PC, but instead of personal computer, it's the personal cloud. The term doesn't particularly matter, right? What's important here is that it's following the same pattern, which is this new ubiquitous capability, right? Massive personal storage, more ubiquitous local networking. It's converging at a time when that capability is solving an acknowledged pre-existing problem, right? Which in this case is relying on other people's or companies' computers that is somewhere far away from you. And that's just one example, right? But it illustrates the point, we think. And so as far as bringing about like the next catalyzing event, you know, we almost, you know, kind of don't have to do anything to bring it about. It's already coming, right? We're already getting more local compute, more powerful local networking, more powerful neighborhood scale networking. Those devices, right, are becoming more available and in fact have been available for quite some time. And so we just have to take advantage of it when it's here, which is what TLC is preparing for by being a school that trains people in how to work with these new capabilities that have already existed for at least 5 or 10 years now.
Got it. Later on in the article, you expound a little bit on social media. Why is social media as we know it so awful? And what would social media look like if it were truly social?
Right. Yeah, this is this was the first of the three interwoven essays that we turned into the article. It was all about social media. It's obviously a hot topic for folks today for many reasons. And what we're trying to do with that sort of essay is sort of get people to think about social media, the words, right, as distinct from social media, the thing that we associate with companies like Twitter and Facebook, right, the thing we think about it. And so what most people think of, right, as social media today is awful because it isn't actually a social medium, like at all. It's like not designed to be that. It isn't designed to be a pro-social technology. It never was. And there's a lot of what, you know, we would think George Orwell would call doublespeak in our world today. This is a great example of that, right? So social media, we have to understand, is not designed to nurture social relations. It's explicitly designed to trigger someone's social needs, but then leave them mostly unfulfilled while offering the social platform, whatever it is that you're using, Twitter or Facebook, whatever, right, as though it's the solution to the problem that they themselves triggered, right? So that's what drives retention. That's how these companies are explicitly built, not just in terms of business model, but in terms of technical implementation, right? Recent documentaries like The Social Dilemma, I think, do a really good job of showcasing just how explicit that effort is, but it is an explicit choice. And so we really shouldn't call it social media, right? We should call it lonely media, because the explicit design goal of sites like Facebook and Twitter is to make you feel lonely and then offer themselves up as that short-term solution to this feeling of loneliness that they've just inspired in you. And that's no different, for example, than how the US healthcare industry is set up to make more profit, right? When the population is generally sick as opposed to healthy, right? It should be called sick care, but we call it for some reason healthcare. And so that analogy is the same, right, for social, or it holds, I guess I should say, for social media as well, right? When we say we want healthcare, what we're obviously asking for, right, as a general population, is that we want a generally healthy population and then also have services to care for us, right, in the short periods of time when we're sick, not the inverse of that. And so when we say we want to use social media, for example, right, what it means is that we want to have a medium that generally serves pro-social ends, right? To have a medium over which we can engage in social behaviors, and that also facilitates the kind of positive social connections that we all, you know, seem to want, right? But that also offers facilities to connect to others, right? For when they are feeling, you know, lonely or disconnected or isolated for some reason, right? Like, you know, I had a bad day. I really want to reach out to my friend right now, right? Like, that's a good thing that social media can do if it was actually social media. Instead, what it tends to do is induce FOMO by doom scrolling, right? And so importantly, the thing to notice by this definition is that all communication technologies could be social media. It's not just Twitter and Facebook, right? Back in the 90s, for example, some of the most radical and forceful mental health advocacy was happening on these sort of mental illness support group web rings, right? Where someone would put up a website and then connect it via a web ring, which is to say simply just a link to another site that then links to another site that then linked to another site. But in an intentional sort of like, actually it was an intentional community online though, right? That was truly a social media. And Twitter wouldn't be invented, right, for another 15 years. And so when we think of social media as like a stand-in for a company like Twitter or Facebook or whatever the new one is, Instagram or TikTok or whatever, right? Like that's a very different meaning of the term social media. And so first and foremost, I think we need to start saying what we mean and meaning what we say. It's one thing to say the word social media, right? But it's like quite another thing to do the thing that the words mean.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. Lonely media seems more than accurate
yeah,
to describe whatever the hell Twitter and Facebook is.
Yeah.
You also explain in detail how a truly social media would likely emphasize a type of localism that would give rise to other benefits such as the blurring of lines between public and private property and a decreased need to depend on invasive security systems which rely on the police. What separates this type of localism from nativist micronationalism or patchwork?
Yeah, this is also a good question and one that we get a lot. So thank you for asking it. I think that probably the most succinct way of describing the difference is that it's enabled by this ease of connectivity right across geographic boundaries, which is to say that it is important to remember, right, and recognize that there are reasons to care about local geography, right? Not least of which, of course, is because humans exist in a physical world with physical bodies, right, and a physical environment. So it makes sense, you know, why awareness of and connection to a local geography and ecology and a regional culture, right, and other aspects of our lives that are necessarily grounded in the physical world would be super important to prioritize. There's a common tendency then, though, to mistake this kind of like respect for the physicality of things as also an inherently, right, like a rejection of other things like long distance communication or economic exchange across, you know, distant bounds. And that's kind of missing the point, right? Like these should be thought of as additive factors, not mutually exclusive ones. So it is possible now, and again, I don't fault anyone for not necessarily thinking too closely about this or thinking through this, because it is, as we've said earlier, right, a new capability that humans haven't had before in the entire history of human of human experience, right? But we do actually have now this ability to have a strong, cohesive, relatively small scale, neighborhood scale region, right? That is also at the same time well connected to other groups of people operating at various scales in various places without any, you know, care for geographical borders or boundaries. And that's a sort of a new mix of things that telecommunication, global instant telecommunication, right, has made possible that we haven't had before. That level of speed and scale meaningfully changes what we can do, not just on a global level, but also on a local level. And so, right, that's the whole point of telecommunication, right? This is something newly possible, something that most people still don't totally know how to make sense of. And that as a society, like writ large, right, we kind of don't know how to add to the way we're thinking about what a just and humane social organization, right? A social society, right? A society would be like. We don't really know what to do with it. And so rather than thinking about these things in a, not to overuse the pun, but like in a binary way, right? Like it has to be either globalist or micronationalist. Maybe a better way to think about it is more as a series of overlays. Like, for example, you're trying to draw a picture, but you're doing it with tracing paper, right? So each layer of tracing paper that you put over the image adds more and more richness to the final picture. And that's the thing that telecommunication makes possible that we didn't really have before. Some of these layers should absolutely be geographically bounded, right? Physical energy, food production, right? I mean, human to human, you know, physical contact, right? Those are physical things. They are necessarily bounded in the physical world. But other elements of such a society, right, does not need to be bound by the same sort of laws of geographic regionality because telecommunication is now possible in a way it wasn't before.
Is it necessary to convince others of the value of freedom in order for your vision to succeed?
No, I don't think it is. Obviously, we think, you know, freedom is a good thing to value, and I think a lot of people already value it, which of course is good. But the you know, to use a somewhat capitalistic framing, right, that the pitch here, right, like our goals here are not abstract things like freedom or, you know, in the American lingo, right, the pursuit of happiness, right? I mean, those are good. We want freedom. We want the pursuit of happiness. You know, we would obviously support these things, but they are very sort of like, you know, highfalutin, you know, vague notions. They mean different things to different people, right? There's a lot of ways to interpret that, that kind of stuff. Our goals are instead very material things, right? Like which people have enough food, you know, how coordinated like is a given network of some neighborhood scale affinity group, right? Like these are concretely measurable things. And so one way to sort of say this is like, you know, values like freedom, again, are like sort of this North Star that we can sail towards, right? But we are in fact way more immediately concerned with like the wind in our sail, right? And the waves hitting the hull of our metaphorical ship. Like that's what actually matters. And so those are measurable, concrete, material, immediate, personal, small scale things that, you know, regardless of whether or not you have a political alignment, right, in theory, you can immediately see the value in practicality of the sort of effort here in your personal life. And that's why, while it's of course nice to work with people who think freedom is good, as opposed to people like, you know, fucking fascists who think freedom is obviously bad, right? Like, it's better to work with the people who you can actually work with towards the same goal. It's not actually a requirement to participate. And that's really important because, again, it means that someone doesn't have to self-identify or even recognize themselves as being part of so-called, you know, putting air quotes here, like part of your group, to then participate in, provide value to, and gain value from the efforts that you're putting forth.
So at one point in the article, you describe how we're making the machines who are buying our thoughts. If this is true, it seems criminally underemphasized in popular discourse. Can you break down what that means and how we can know that it's actually happening? You're probably wondering why you're hearing the outro music when we clearly have not finished our chat with Tech Learning Collective. Well, time flies when you're having fun, and talking to TLC was so great that our conversation ended up being a bit longer than we originally anticipated. Long story short, we decided to break this conversation up into two parts. And if you would like to immediately gain access to the second half of this episode, as well as other exclusive C4SS content, head on over to patreon.com/c4ss.org to support our efforts in spreading the message of vibrant social cooperation without aggression, oppression, or centralized authority. Otherwise, you can expect to hear the remainder of this conversation for free in 1 week. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in.